I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. This time we begin the Tech National, as we've done for the last 35 and a fraction years, starting in 1982. Main purpose of the Tech National, as you guys already know, is education. Curious radio amateurs gather at this time for quite a few hours of discussion of their favorite subject: ham radio, transmitters, receivers, antennas, feed lines, propagation. 26 different kinds of ham radio. There's a lot to this hobby. Arguably, one of the most discussed subjects on the TechNet is antennas. The subject of antennas, because they could be covered better in the books. It's a complicated subject, and the books do most of the books do a mediocre job of really explaining what goes on inside of an antenna. Last week, we had a significant discussion by Steve, KD2HUC, on his MFJ manufactured Alpha Delta DXCC multi-band trap dipole, and he sent me some nice pictures of the modifications he has made, what he has discovered. So he's made quite a bit of progress. We'll be hearing from Steve. I think we're going to be hearing from Freddy, KB2VBN. On previous weeks he's attempted to sign in, and then when we got around to getting to him, he wasn't there. And maybe we'll be hearing from Eric too, KB2EJ. Let me check first. Freddie, are you signing in tonight? KB2VBN from Far Rockaway, K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is KB2VBN. Yes, and I have a question for the next.
Okay, Freddie is signed in. Steve, I bet you're going to be there also. KD2HUC, are you available tonight? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yep, KD2HUC, I'm here.
Okay. And I think Eric is going to be signing in too. KE2EJ, are you there tonight, Eric? K2RIW in the TechNet.
I think I'm here. Remind me.
Okay. Out of curiosity, should I put you on a list for somebody who's got a question or a comment? Over to you, Eric.
No, I think the last thing we were talking about was kind of split up and went by the side, but I don't have anything pressing this evening.
Okay, maybe you'll think of something. My guess is we also have Paul on board, WS2N. If so, he's going to be giving us a space report number 269. Out of curiosity, are you available tonight, Paul? If I didn't know, WS2N, K2IW, and the TechNet.
This is WS2N, and yes, I am available and checking in, but no questions yet this evening. Maybe I'll think of something later. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, and one call. If anyone else want to check in because they do have a question or a comment for the TechNet tonight, please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
November 2. We request N2HUH, nice to have useful hands. Handy Andy in Queens, New York. Yes.
Okay, we got Handy Andy and Rich N2EO in that order. Anyone else want to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, we got more than enough. Freddy, you're number one on the runway tonight. KB2, Victor Bravo November. The voice of Far Rockaway, K2IW. You got it, Freddy.
This is KB2VBN, New York City, Eric. I have a question. All the members of New York City, Eric, have taken in a list of what kind of power do you have and antenna system do you have in case of emergency. I'm using a Black & Decker portable power station with a jump starter, air compressor, built-in power supply. And I'm using a Yaesu FT mobile radio plus an Anchime 20 amp power. It's a Black & Decker power station. I can see how long I can talk if there's a serious.
That sounds like a nice standby. by system you've got there, Freddie. Black & Decker Power Station, FT-7900 mobile rig. And what's your guess, Freddie, as to how many ampere hours you've got on the battery of that Black & Decker Power Station? This is question number one. Your 7900, I'm not sure, but probably in the low power mode, it draws less than 10 amperes. So if the Black & Decker has something like a gel cell or a car battery, which might be good for, well, I'm going to pick a number, 20 ampere hours, and if your rig draws only a few amperes, you've got quite a few hours of service there. So have you worried about any of those details, Freddie, as to how many ampere hours the Black & Decker battery is good for? And maybe the manual on your 7900 tells you how much current it draws in the high power mode and the low power mode. And quite often you can be pleasantly surprised that the real current it draws is less. The manufacturer is a little bit on the conservative side to make sure somebody's got a big enough power supply. So it sounds like you're in good shape for standby power if Hurricane Maria happens to come along. KB2VBN, K2RIW, go ahead, Freddie.
Yes, sir. Yeah, I've been talking on this thing for 4 hours. I mean, 4 days. 4 days checking into all these different nets around the Fremantle area, and it's still running. And I haven't charged this thing up in 4 months. And I will never do this test unless all these things was happening with the weather. There might be future hurricanes coming our way. That might be pretty bad. And the New York City Ericsson Group is trying to get all its members ready just in case of emergencies like this, or even with the North Korea problem over there in North Korea, too. This is KB2-BBN.
That's amazing. So you've been using it for 4 days. I think you said you haven't charged it in 4 months. You got to be careful on this one, Freddie. You could easily run into the trouble that I created. I took a lead-acid battery. I think it was a gel cell, but it certainly would be even worse with a car battery type. And as we've discovered with past discussions on the TechNet, if you discharge a lead-acid battery beyond the 50% point, let's assume that your battery is good for 40 ampere hours, for instance, and if you discharge it to 20 ampere hours, that would be the 50% point, you can go further. But when you go beyond the 50% point, you're doing damage to the battery. The next time you charge it, it won't have as much charge left anymore. So be careful you don't over-discharge. We know that Rich N2EO was using lead-acid batteries on his electrically powered wheelchair. Let me drop. And he was letting those batteries go all the way down to the ground before recharging them. The instructions that came with his wheelchair told him to recharge it every night. And he said, gee, why should I have to recharge it every night? I didn't discharge it that far. Well, there's a big advantage of keeping your lead-acid batteries always charged more than 50%. Don't go beyond the 50% discharge, otherwise you're doing damage. You won't see it as damage, but the next time you check on how much capacity it's got left, it'll have less. So you might not want to take this test you're running too much further, Freddie, because you might be down to the 50% point on that battery. Even though it'll go further, you shouldn't do that unless you really have to when it's an emergency. KB2VBN, K2RIW, go ahead, Freddie.
Yeah, Roger. Yes, sir. Yeah, it's pretty low. When I press the indication button, it's a one red zone. It's low. I'm going to do it as you said. I'm not going to push it. I'm going to make sure this thing works for the emergencies. What I'm going to do is charge it up, put it on charge, and use my HT to check into some of the nets tonight, like the Big Apple traffic nets.
Yeah, if that meter is showing you're already in the red zone, it's time to recharge it. Even though you can go a lot further, you're doing damage when you do that. And another test you can do, when that battery is in the charge mode, it's possible you can use it with your radio. In other words, you don't have to go over to the handy-dandy. As long as it's being charged, sometimes you can run the radio at the same time. Depending on how good the battery is and the particular design of your charging network, you may get some extra hum out of the 7900 when you're running it during charge. And so that gives you two choices. One, find out how bad is the hum. Maybe you can just tolerate the hum. Or maybe you turn up the charge just while you're keying the rig and then turn the charge back on while you're in the listening mode. To go back to charging it is something I strongly recommend. Back to you for any final on this one, Freddie. KB2VBN. Good thing you got a hold of us tonight so you don't damage your battery. KQLIW in the TechNet.
Roger, as we speak, my radio is humming from this battery. It's been humming for 4 days. I'm going to turn it off. Matter of fact, I'm going to charge it up with the charging mode and listen at the same time. This is KB2VBN.
Yeah, why don't you turn on the charger and come back to us and let's see how you find if the battery is being charged while you're running the transmitter. Let's see how you sound. You might sound pretty good, in which case you can do both at the same time, Freddie. Go ahead.
Right, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to go get the extension cord and hook it up to this power station and plug it into the wall.
Okay. We'll come back to you later and we'll run that test. Steve is the next guy, KD2HUC. Nice photographs you sent us, Steve. What Steve did was to inspect his rig, his Alpha Delta DXCC trap dipole antenna. Let me drop it. He found one place where the wire was coming close to a tree limb, and it was arcing over to the tree limb. He also found some twisting on the spacers. They were giving him some grief. But even so, even though he corrected all these things, still he had a pretty high standing wave ratio on 80 meters, so he added an extra foot to the tail on each side of the antenna beyond the loading coil. And that at 3800 got him down to something like 1.6 to 1, which is a pretty respectable standing wave ratio. When you read the product reports on the antenna, depending on who you read it from, they say it's either 25 kilohertz wide or 60 kilohertz wide, but it's a relatively narrow band antenna on 80 meters because it's compressed in size. So adjusting those tails beyond the loading coil to get it to resonate on your favorite frequency seems to be a good thing to do. And looks like that worked out very nicely for you, Freddie. So go ahead and tell us anything you want to about that antenna. Sounds like you resurrected it from the dead on 80 meters. KD2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I don't even know if I could use the word resurrected because it was kind of dead out of the bag. For the life of me, I still don't know why. But I ended up adding an extra foot of cable over what came from the factory. And that put me in, let's see, I'm looking at it right now. At 3.78, I'm now looking at 1.5 SWR. Let me let it drop. If you remember, the resistive component was about 7, and I got that up to about 35. So that was a good thing. Now, the only interesting thing that I came across is that when I was plotting it out, which I guess you kind of answered, is it wasn't a bathtub shaped curve, but it was more like just an inverted peak. So, but then you pointed out that this antenna, I guess by design, is inherently narrow banded. So, but this was the first time I was actually able to get my radio to tune up on it without an external tuner, and I was actually able to drive, tune my amp up into it and get about 8,800 watts into it without causing any grief. So, I'm a happy camper now. KD2HUC, back to net.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that to our attention. On many antennas that are full size in length, when you plot standing wave ratio versus frequency, you get sort of a bathtub curve where it comes down and it's kind of rounded off a little bit on the bottom. When you get an antenna that has the trunk in size, as this one has been, and you've got loading coils and top hat capacitors and so on it. When you use frequency narrow banding techniques in order to squeeze the antenna down. And that curve becomes a V-shaped curve. That's what you've seen. That's a very sharp V. And it's probably 25 or 50 kilohertz wide at the 2-to-1 standing wave ratio point. And when you get it down to 1.5-to-1, that's pretty respectable. And now you know that by adjusting the length of those tails, you can measure, you can make it resonate anywhere you want to in the 80-meter band, but you're only going to get 25 kc of a bandwidth or so. So you've got to be a little bit careful in how you set that to your favorite frequency. Now, I believe, let me drop it. I'm going to guess that the antenna analyzer you used, maybe it was an MFJ, it had told you 7 ohms of resistance and 27 ohms of reactance. And we weren't sure if the 27 ohms was inductive or capacitive. I made a guess that it could have been inductive. And you've got 230 feet of RG8 coax. And 230 feet of RG8 coax, when you include the 66% velocity factor, I think it's something like 2.3 wavelengths. Look, I forget the number of wavelengths, but every wavelength, the reflected signal goes another 360 degrees. So when you take out the 360-degree wraps, calculation of the length of your cable left over beyond 360 degrees is 117 degrees. So I went to my formula in my handheld calculator, my Hewlett-Packard 52, HP50, I think it is, graphic. And I've got a formula where you can crank back out the length of the cable as if you were using a Smith chart, but by doing it with an equation, you get a much more exact answer. Let me drop it. So you measured 7 ohms resistive and 27 ohms reactive in the shack. And if I remove the 230 feet of cable mathematically, not counting its insertion loss, I did it simple. Your next question is, what was the real impedance right at the antenna? And these numbers are going to be a little bit flaky, because I don't know the exact length of your cable, its exact velocity factor, and we're not quite sure about the antenna analyzers. When you start getting a pretty high visual, you had like an 11-to-1 standing wave ratio. Antenna analyzers with that high a standing wave ratio, the errors start building up. But even so, if we use that numbers, crank out the cable, the calculated impedance at your antenna is 460 ohms of resistance, and where did I write it down here? 460 ohms of resistance, and I think it was 118 ohms of reactance, negative. So, and when you work out the mathematics of that, it's still the same visual, 9-to-1, 11-to-1, you know, it's still a high number. The length of the cable, under normal circumstances, with a good balance, does not change the magnitude of your visual. It changes the phase angle. Therefore, how much resistance and how much reactance you see goes around on that Smith chart. It's a circle drawn on that Smith chart. And your length of cable puts your dot somewhere on that circle. So you've got a constant visual, but the resistor component and the reactive component go up and down in funny ways. So 450 ohms. It's academic. Now, your particular antenna analyzer, Steve, does it have the ability to put a negative sign in front of the reactive component? It told you you got 7 ohms of resistance. It told you you had 27 ohms of reactance. Does that instrument panel, does it have a negative...
Repeater, timeout.
Does it have a negative sign that it could have turned on in front of the reactive component? KD2HUC, K2LIW in the TechNet. You've got it, Steve.
No, Dick, it does not. And last we spoke, if I remember, you were giving, you were saying that if it increases in frequency, then it was most likely inductive, and that if it decreased, it was most likely capacitive, is what I have written down here. And then after that, I wanted to get into another reading that this thing is giving, because that I'm not... you know, quite clear on how to interpret. 82HUC, back to net.
Yeah, an ordinary dipole, without loading coils, without traps and all of the doodads on it, when you go above the resonant frequency, the antenna is inductive. When you go lower in frequency than the resonant frequency, the antenna is capacitive. That's universal. You can find that out by looking at the Brown and Woodward curves which are in amateur radio dot tango Victor, and also in limarktechnet.com. In both cases, you'll find tuning a dipole by K2RIW, and you'll see those curves, and you'll see that information. However, when you've got a loading coil at the end and these tails after the loading coil, the network is becoming a lot more complicated. Will it follow the simple inductive above resonant, capacitor below resonant? Probably, but I wouldn't stake my life on it. I can see how you could hit a series resonance of that coil plus the tail beyond the coil, the loading coil, and you can get some pretty funny effects, if you know what I mean. So, what did you see on your antenna analyzer that you'd like to have a further explanation of, Steve? KD2HUC, K2RIW in the Tech National.
Well, it has this mode on it where it gives what it's calling coax loss. And even with my nice newly tuned setup and I'm seeing a nice 1.5 VISWAR, it's indicating the coax loss is 6.5 dB. That's a lot of power to be losing to coax. So I'm wondering, am I interpreting this right, or does this actually mean something else? KD2HUC, back to net.
I'm not sure, but I think you're using cable that either is or it's very similar to RG8U. RG213, RG8, and RG8X, RG8U, the full-size polyethylene insulated coax cable. And there's loads of places you can go on the TechNet. You can also go to what your particular manufacturer is. Maybe it's Amphenol, maybe it's Brown and Woodward, you know, whoever manufactured your cable. You can look up his chart of insertion loss per 100 feet, and whatever that number is in decibels. In your case, you're going to multiply it by 2.3 because you've got 230 feet. And so at 80 meters, would that particular cable have, let's see now, if I take out, you said 6 dB, if I divide that by 2.3, it's going to turn out to be, 2.5 dB per 100 feet. Does RG8 have 2.5 dB per 100 feet on 80 meters? I don't think so. I don't think it's that high. Maybe that antenna analyzer, let me drop it. It's trying to tell you that when you measure standing wave ratio, that it is recognizing the fact that standing wave ratio means the antenna is not a perfect match, that some of the power goes up the cable, hits the antenna, and some of it gets reflected back because the antenna is not a pure 50 ohm load. The signal that comes back into the shack is been through the cable twice, and two transverses through the cable can give you 6 dB of loss, when it's only 3 dB of loss one way. That sounds right. So I think they're telling you that it's dialing up the standing wave ratio. If I take your exact numbers and plug it into a standing wave ratio chart, it comes out to be 9.3 to 1, not 11 to 1. So when the machine told you 11 to 1, it's possibly doing the calculation of going through the cable twice. That's a guess on my part. And maybe the owner's manual will make that clear to you, but 6 dB on 80 meters sounds high. But you can check that by going to many of the charts for RG8, and you can go to the particular chart for your particular brand of coax. And assuming that it's not a zillion years old and hasn't been soaked in salt water, you should be able to get that exact loss as I see it, to Steve. KD2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, here's where it gets interesting, Dick. It seems that it's saying the coax loss peaks at the lowest SWR. As I adjust the frequency, off of the resonant frequency, so that SWR would be increasing, it's saying the coax loss comes down. And let me let it drop.
Yeah, I can explain that one, but go ahead.
Well, I'm still in my quote-unquote test mode for this. I'm not actually back on the RG213 that I actually ran out to the antenna for this. When I originally had the problem, I also have underground half-inch hardline that I use for VHF and UHF service. I pulled that off, and I hooked that up to try and reduce the amount of loss that I could be getting from reflected power. So that's what's actually in right now. So it works out to be probably about 120 feet of RG-213, and the remaining of it is actually half-inch iliac. So I don't know how that factors into the mix, but KD2HEC, back to net.
Now, one of the confusing factors when it comes to coax loss is various people have written articles saying that there's this extra loss because of standing wave ratio. And that's on the assumption you're using an ideal antenna tuner in the shack. Assuming now your antenna has got a 5.8-to-1 standing wave ratio. That means of all the power that hits it, exactly half of it gets reflected. That gives you 3 dB of loss if you were not using an antenna tuner and you had a pure 50 ohm resistive transmitter. There's a bunch of assumptions there. We won't go there. So 5.8-to-1, half the power is reflected. With an ideal antenna tuner in the shack, that power gets re-reflected forward. And so you don't lose it all, but you're going to lose a fraction of it because you've got power bouncing back and forth. And even the power that you reflect forward again, not all of that gets absorbed. It gets reflected back. So there's a bunch of bouncing going on. So they talk about extra loss due to this one. As you tune the antenna to the frequency where you're getting into the bottom of that V-shaped curve of VISWR versus frequency, let me drop. The VISWR you're experiencing at that point, at the bottom of the V, is a lower number. Therefore, the amount of bouncing back and forth between the antenna and your antenna tuner in the shack, that amount of bouncing gets less. Therefore, the excess loss of the cable goes down. So they're telling you something that's pretty truthful. So it's one step beyond what the average person knows to ask about when he's using an antenna tuner and measuring this one. So that extra loss comes about because of the multiple bounces at high VISWR between your antenna tuner and the real antenna. Back to you, Steve. KD2HUC, K2RIW, and the Tech National.
Yeah, but Dick, I'm seeing the opposite of that. I'm seeing the antenna analyzer is reporting the highest coax loss at the lowest VISWR. And then as you shift off of the frequency, as VISWR comes up, it's saying the coax loss is coming down. So that's what's confusing me. KD2HEC, back to net.
Yeah, that confuses me too. That's a little bit crazy. So maybe reading the manual might explain that, but boy, that sounds opposite of what I know about with coax and standing wave ratio. I'm with you. Something's wrong on that one. Maybe the machine was manufactured in Southeast Asia, and maybe the translation from Chinglish to English, something got lost. That's a guess. But now, is the frequency at the bottom of your V-shaped curve of VISWR, is on the frequency you like most? And if not, you added an extra foot to each side on those tails. And there's nothing magic about that foot. If you wanted to go a little bit lower, you could make it a foot and a half or 2 feet and so on. It's not going to explode. And by the way, the piece of cable that arced over to the branch, where was that piece of cable? Was that part of the 80-meter antenna? Was that one of the tails on the end? What was actually arcing over to the branch, Steve? KD2HUC, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
It was actually a portion of the 40-meter element, so it was between the inductors. So it was in between one of the inductors and the feed point.
And even though you weren't using the antenna on 40 meters, that still could disturb your measurements on 80 meters. Because on 40 meters, actually, when you're on 80 meters, you're hoping that the 80-meter antenna presents a reasonable impedance near 50 ohms. The 40-meter antenna is way too short. It's probably presenting 1,000 ohms or so of capacitive reactance because it's too short for 80. Therefore, the 40-meter antenna becomes an open circuit. The 20-meter antenna becomes an open circuit. And they electronically switch themselves out because their impedance goes so high. If the 40-meter dipole is really in free space, if now the 40-meter dipole, when you're on 80 meters, is arcing over to the branch, all bets are off. The 40-meter antenna could start becoming a 50-ohm resistor. It's not an open circuit anymore. And so, therefore, it can reflect a crazy reactance, a crazy resistance. So that arcing, even though it was a 40-meter antenna, could be affecting your measurements on 80 meters. But even after you corrected the arc, before you added the pigtails, the extra foot of length, you still had a pretty high Vizslar at 80 meters, didn't you? Across the whole Don band, Steve, KD2HUC, K2IW.
Actually, I couldn't tell you, Dick, because once the antenna was down on the ground, I added the additional links while it was down. Like I said, it's the way the antenna is oriented, it's less than friendly to put up and down. So once I took it down, I made all the corrections that needed to be made, and then I put it back up, and it kind of fell where I liked it. It's about 3.7 megahertz is the inverted peak, so that's where I'm seeing resonance right now. But let me let it drop.
Is that where you want it to be?
Mr. Steve. Forward a little bit. I did leave some slack up there and folded it over, so I should be able to add a little bit more length to it just by dropping the ends. But, it doesn't have to be dead on. I'm seeing much better performance than I ever did out of the thing. Let me let it drop. And, you know, to tell you the truth, I wouldn't have even found the arcing because, like I said, I would have only dropped the ends. It was only because, you know, everybody kept saying last week about maybe the coax was filled with water and all this other stuff, so I decided it was a good time to hit it hard with a megger. And funny how, it tells all tales. No pun intended. And so right away I knew something was wrong, and I knew the whole antenna had to come down. KD2, HUC, back to net.
For Steve.
Yeah, personally, we've got a question for Steve. Give us your call letters, your name, and proceed with your question.
H2FIU, this is George. I was on last week. I was the one who mentioned that I had built one based on some 60-year-old text with references actually back to text in the 1920s about the effectiveness of the loading coil. My question for Steve is that I believe you said you had the Alpha Delta model, and I believe they come with 12-gauge solid copper. And my question is, did you just lengthen what was there with the wire they gave you on the tail segment? Or did you actually add something, and what did you add to it? KD2FIU.
You got it, Steve.
Moved the factory tails and made new ones out of my own 12-gauge wire.
Yeah, that 12-gauge wire is difficult to work with. Yeah. Okay, very good. Interesting about how Alpha Delta uses that wire, for one thing. And I don't know if they're using 120 Michael Henry loading coils, you're going to look at probably around 34 feet, 3 to 5 inches for the first segment, the loading coil, and then about 4 feet, 3 or 4 inches for the second segment. Is that what you found, Steve?
As far as the tails, yeah, the tails were approximately 4 feet, and now they're approximately 6 feet. And as you guys pointed out, I did test the coils. I didn't test them as far as inductance. I just tested them. You know, Dick had proposed that maybe the insulation was breaking down between the windings, so I did test. Those coils are clean as can be. The insulation is in perfect health. So that's why I said I'll go with making the tails even longer than factory. And lo and behold, here it is. KD2HUC, back to net.
KD2FIU, clear.
Very fine, George. One last question, Steve. Did the instruction manual on your ADDXCC trap dipole, did it recommend a particular apex angle? You've got an inverted V. You didn't stretch it out completely straight. does the owner's manual give you any data on how much angle you're allowed to put, or what's their recommendation on that? T2HUC, K2RIW, go ahead, Steve.
If memory serves, Dick, they did not offer an angle, but I do remember them saying that it was tested, you know, out of the factory for a height approximately 40 feet, and now I'm above that. So that, you know, I don't know how, you, well, I mean, we talked about that, the whole chart where height versus impedance and so on and so forth. So I definitely think that by raising it the additional 20 feet, it probably changed the impedance somewhat, because originally when I was about 35 feet, I was seeing ridiculous SWR 15 to 1 or greater on 80 meters.
Yeah, that's a little bit mysterious. And now you're at 40 feet or so, maybe 45 feet. That's at the center, and the tips are roughly how many feet off the ground? Eric, here we go, Steve, go ahead.
No, Dick, right now the apex is approximately 60 to 65 feet, and the end of the tails is about 20, 25 feet. So with that, I mean, we could calculate the angle, but, I mean, I could change the angle. I could change the angle if I go and I tighten up the ropes that hold up the ends. I could tighten it up. But I don't know how well that would affect the angle of radiation as far as, you know, being able to work good DX. I mean, a lot of the guys have been telling me, you know, the inverted V is good for DX because it, you know, it hits the ionosphere at a more shallow angle and so on and so forth. So that's what I'm being told. I you know, I don't have any measurable data to go with it. KD2HEC, back to net.
The fact that it's an inverted V versus a flat-out dipole and angle to the horizon, I'm having trouble with that one. I don't think so, when you're talking about broadside. However, an inverted V gives you one other huge advantage. An ordinary flat-out dipole parallel to the ground gives you a very deep null off the end. When you're looking at the end of the dipole, very little signal is going out that way. All the signal is going broadside. When you make it an inverted V, and you look at it from the end, you're standing out at the horizon and you're looking back at the antenna, you're looking at a slanted, vertically polarized antenna. So an inverted V radiates a vertically polarized signal off the end, it radiates a horizontally polarized signal broadside, and it angles midway between the two. It's giving you a slant polarization. So you get a hell of a lot more 360-degree coverage in azimuth with an inverted V. So I would leave it. I wouldn't try to correct that. And if you start correcting, let me drop this. If you start making measurements of its best VISWR versus the inverted V angle, how far you bring down the tips, when you're at the altitude you're at, you're going to find out that the change is very slowly. It's not going to be a big factor. So I wouldn't worry about raising those tips as I see it. I think the next thing is for you to do is to make some good QSOs on 80 meters and come back next week and tell us how well it's working, Steve. Any final comments before we leave you? KD2HUC, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Yeah, the only comment I have is that, as you pointed out, having the inverted only give me a little more radiation towards the tips, and considering that my dipole, by the nature of my yard, is oriented east to west, to somebody looking to work across the pond, that's certainly a favorable condition for me, wouldn't it? KD2HEC, back to net. For your help, gentlemen.
Yeah, if you looked at an ordinary flat map, you would think that England is east of us. That's not the Great Circle Pass. You get a real three-dimensional globe, and you put one end of the string on New York City, with the other end of the string on London, and I think you're going to find out that the angle from New York City to London is about 45 degrees azimuth, you know, northeast. Great Circle angles work out kind of crazy. So you're purely east-west, and you're not quite broadside anymore when it comes to talking to England. So an inverted V is going to give you some nice coverage. So we'll be looking forward to hearing how many 80 meter QSOs you made next week, assuming the band's in good shape. Okay, the next person was Handy Andy, N2HUH, on that hill in Richmond Hill, Queens. Go right ahead, Andy, T2RIW in the TechNet. N2HUH, you there, Andy? They're playing your song, T2RIW. Go ahead, Andy. Okay, maybe he got called away. We'll come back to him. Rich is next on my list, N2EO. Go right ahead, Rich, N2EO, K2RIW. Hello, anybody? Am I alone? Okay. Pass it over to Eric to see if he's got anything he wants to add to all of the above, or anything you'd like to tell us about television in general. KE2EJ, if you're available. K2RIW, go ahead, Eric. K2RIW, KE2EJ. Anything in particular you want to know about? Yeah. When it comes to a 4K high-resolution television set that I could buy today, my guess is there may be one or two channels on some of the better cable companies or satellite companies, and if I was watching over-the-air broadcast, is there any high, super high-definition television being broadcast at this time in the New York City area? KE2EJ, KQRIW.
They come really here.
All right, well, you pick up Rich in a second. At this point in time, there's no 4K broadcast over the air. You get 4K out of your Fios, you can get it out of your cable vision. You can get it from Netflix and a few other services, if you don't mind letting this stuff buffer so it builds up enough so it can keep up. I mean, there's also 4K DVDs, believe it or not. They're not widespread yet, but they're coming. And the high dynamic range is interesting, where some of the stuff that's being distributed by Fios and cable and Netflix don't have the HDR component in it yet, but that's also coming. Back to you, Dick. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Yeah, give me a couple of words on that. If I'm looking at a 4K picture that is or isn't HDR, maybe the 4K is HDR, will I see blacker blacks and whiter whites and more individual chrominance colors? If I put my nose up to the screen, how much difference am I going to see, Eric? Go ahead.
Now, the difference in a non-HDR and HDR is kind of like, now if you want to go back to, say, the 60s and 70s in film, where they all of a sudden made a change in the granularity of the negative film, where it's actually able to resolve more steps of light, so to speak. That kind of a difference. The HD that you're generally looking at a TV is 8 bits wide, so it's actually, it's less than 256 steps of light. Some of the later stuff is 10 bits wide, so you get 1024 number of steps of brightness, and with HDR it can actually be 24 bits wide. So what that really means is that if you're looking at a scene that's set up for drama or really dramatic visual effects, let me let it drop. Your ability to resolve what's in those dark areas increases by a number of times when you're looking at an HDR picture. And if you're not looking at an HDR picture, you won't be able to see those details in the dark areas. The displays themselves have a limitation in terms of how much individual steps of light it can actually produce, and that's why the better sets that are being marketed as HDR, using OLEDs, which have the ability to create a larger number of steps than the traditional LCD type of displays. You know, you may have a LED set which still has a liquid crystal in front of it to produce the picture,
particular is the LED is a light source, but it is not the individual points of light that are the pixels, whereas in the OLED, the individual pixels are the LEDs themselves. K2RWK2J.
Okay, what's your guess as to the approximate price of an OLED HDR 4K set and let's say close to 50 inch diagonal screen? Am I talking around $650 today, Eric? KE2EJ, K2IW?
I don't think we're quite at $650 yet, but we're getting close. You can buy 4K sets that are as cheap as $300, but not 50 inches. Actually, I can look up what the current pricing is. If you go back like 2 years, the first 4K sets were in the $2,000 and $3,000 range, but those prices have dropped tremendously.
The OLED individual emitters on that screen, I'm guessing they've got pretty fine gradation to them. You only see the individual pixels when I'm inches away from that screen, is a guess on my part. Do they have any drawbacks? Do they have aging characteristics, burn-in? Do they get dim and timed? Or is that the state-of-the-art in screens these days, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Now, the technology is getting better.
In front.
But the one thing they don't advertise is that OLEDs have a life. And after X period of time, they don't produce the same amount of light. And the length of life is considerably shorter than what you would expect from a normal LED type of device. So, yeah, it's getting better. They don't really advertise that, the clock starts when you start playing your TV set. They guarantee X amount of hours, and after that, you're on your own.
Yeah, somebody, he has some info. I'm going to pick him up in an instant. When you say they've got shorter life, do the OLEDs versus LEDs, are we talking about a 2-to-1 ratio in life? And give me a rough guess. Will I see some dimming in 1 year, or will I only see dimming after 5 years? Yeah. Give me a rough order of magnitude here, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, it's kind of a moving target, Jake. Actually, the broadcasters had OLEDs, what you call a standards monitor, for a number of years now. And the first one, they really only lasted about 2 years. The next generation, I think, is up to like 4 years. So I don't know what the actual time of the commercial products that are being produced now, but I suspect it's going to be 4 or 5 years. And another year or two, it might be 6 or 7 years. You know, it's an ongoing thing. It really is a moving target.
When you said they only lasted 2 years, the very early ones, at 2 years, did they start getting dim? Were certain colors they couldn't reproduce? What did I see after 2 years on those very early models, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
Now, don't forget these monitors that I'm talking about, the early ones that were used by the broadcasters. They're very sophisticated monitors. They actually have a probe built into them. So before you start another production, you pop the probe on the screen and you readjust it electronically to produce the right color temperature outputs. As you might be aware, the colorimetry of each individual pixel, red, green, and blue, are going to have different rates of depletion. So, as time goes on with the commercial stuff, you would readjust. And, let's say you had a brightness range of 150 to 1. At the end of 2 years, you were down to maybe 120 to 1. So you get it. I mean, it's not that dramatic, but it is a real dimming process. And they don't lose their output evenly in terms of color, so you wind up getting color balance shifts as time goes on. And if you're smart enough to readjust it, it's not an issue. But again, the technology is getting better each time they produce more. So, you know, it's a moving target in terms of the consumer stuff. Whereas the broadcast stuff has gotten much better. But then again, it's still a process where you set up standard and create a standard and keep it to the standard. So, no, as your tires wear, there comes a point where you're going to replace them. That's the same sort of deal. K2RW, K2J.
I'm guessing that the red, green, and blue age at slightly different rates, and when you're doing this compensation with the probe, I'm guessing eventually one of those red, green, or blue runs out of compensation range, and either you're going to set the whole screen dimmer or live with a lacking luminance of one of those chrominance colors. That's a guess on my part. The person who said he has some information, please give us your call letters, your name, and then proceed with the information. K2RW in the TechNet.
Hi, good evening, Dick. Name here is Nick, N-I-C-K, and the call is November 2, Hotel Victor Radio. Just quickly, 2 months ago, I purchased a Sony 4K TV, which is 49-50-inch one, and I got it in Best Buy. I got a good deal for like $680. Thing works great. I use Spectrum cable. And all the cable channels, I don't know if they're coming through on 4K, but the picture's a lot better than when I had a Sony Bravia before that that was just HD. It's a big improvement. What I did notice is when I play DVD movies on my Sony surround sound system, the picture is considerably better when you play it off a DVD onto a 4K TV. And that's all I wanted to add. Back to net. This is N2HVR.
Thank you, Nick. And some more good information. I was using a cathode ray tube set up until a year or so ago, maybe 2 years ago. And when I bought my inexpensive Vizio, which is a significant improvement over my cathode ray tube set with a converter in front. But now that I got this pocket full of money burning a hole, if the new sets are significantly better, maybe it's time for me to get another one. Eric is slowly talking me into that too. Okay, we're going to go over to Rich. Wait a minute, let me put something out there. What was that, Steve? I mean, Eric?
The compensations that make him feel that the picture looks better is, first of all, the technology between his old set and his new set is considerably different, okay? And his old set might have been 720p, even though it says it's capable of producing 1080i, which is typical of a lot of older stuff. You can't make champagne out of something that starts off at a particular rate. The DVD, if it's not a Blu-ray DVD, which is 1080i or 720p, typical DVDs, or what we call DVDs, are the 525 line devices. They're actually what we call 720 by 486 in terms of pixel. Many of the 4K sets have an up converter in them, which they play some really good tricks, which actually makes the picture look sharper. It takes some of it and adds some detail, which actually isn't there, so your eyeballs see a much light, or what you appears to be a much nicer looking picture, but there are other artifacts that come into play. So, no matter what kind of tricks can you play on the eyes that will make people say the things that they're saying, because that's what they interpret and what they see. But the reality is, if something starts at a certain resolution and you do something to make a higher resolution, you're inventing that, and generally you can't make something that looks pretty good in its native form. And when you do something to upconvert it, you're usually paying for it in some form. I just wanted to throw that out there. K2RWK2EJ.
Okay, I thank you for that information. Let me make a quick call to Freddie and see if he's come back with his charger. KB2VBN, are you there, Fred? K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, he hasn't. Now let's see if Andy has come back. N2HUH. Are you back with us, Andy? K2LIW in the TechNet. Okay. Rich, N2EO. Wonder if you've replaced those batteries on your wheelchair. I know you were thinking of doing that because they're down in capacity because they had been discharged too deeply. N2EO, K2RIW, you got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick, as far as the batteries, I have not changed them as of yet. Quite frankly, I don't have the money to do it right now, but I charge them every night, it's working out. My question, which is probably pretty mundane as to what you were talking about. I know you brought up subjects like oil burners and the cowboard and water tanks. I have a question similar. Is it okay?
Yep. That's a subject that amateur radio operators are interested in because the smarter ones are willing to open the case on their transceiver and check on the power supply voltages. By the same token, we don't think there's rocket science when it comes to the furnace that's in the house or the hot water heater. So we maintain those too. So go right ahead, Rich. N2EO, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick. I don't know if you've been listening. I'm going to be moving upstate to, I'm right in the foothills of the Catskills. I'm not going to go into the regions, but, I don't want to spend any money right now that I don't have to. With that being said, 2 days ago, my Mr. Coffee died. Worked the day before, we turned it on the following day, nothing was happening. Is it necessary the heating element? Are there any micro switches or any valves in there to protect when you remove the pot from it spewing out hot coffee? If you or somebody else know, if I can fix it easily, I will.
Yeah, my wife has a coffee maker that after it makes the coffee, it keeps the coffee warm afterwards. And in order to make sure that the heating element doesn't overdo the job, there was an auxiliary thermal detecting switch in series with that heating element. And that series switch, in my case, failed. Therefore, the heating element was an open circuit all the time. Not a recommended thing to do. But what I did was to simply short out that auxiliary thermal overload switch, and hers is back in operation. Now, you own a digital voltmeter. Let me drop it. You own a digital voltmeter, and if you're very careful with using it, because some of this testing is going to have to be done, by way of the ohmmeter test, and take the case off your Mr. Coffee and find out, does the heating element measure a reasonable number of ohms? And maybe the answer is 10 ohms if it's a 100-watt heating element. Let me think if that's right. 10 ohms would draw 10 amps. Now, that'd be 1,000 watts. I don't think it's going to go that high, but some reasonable number of ohms. You can find out, does the heating element have a reasonable number of ohms? If it's an open circuit, you give it a good, sharp inspection, and maybe you'll find the break, and maybe there's a way of fixing the break. More likely, you're going to find out the heating element is in good shape. There's probably another series thermal detecting switch for thermal overload that it might have become an open circuit. Your ohmmeter will show you that. Let me drop. And once you confirm that all the wiring to the thermal protect switch and the heating element with your ohmmeter is all in good shape, then after that, there's probably some kind of a timing network. It might be a mechanical timer. It might be a microprocessor. But that timing element has got a switch that's got to go on and off. And you may find out that it has failed. And now you've got to be a lot more careful because in order to test that, you may have to plug it in, so to speak, and find out by signal tracing, where's the voltage and where is it not. You've got to be very careful that you don't touch the wrong thing while it's plugged in, while you get the case off. But I guarantee you can find out what has failed, and I bet you there's an 80% chance you can bring it back to life. In the case of that coffee maker, in my wife's case, I think we used that one for 2 more years after that failure, and since we replaced it with something more moderate. So there's no